Welcome to Robert Bellissimo at the Movies. This is a YouTube video podcast exploring storytelling on film, as well as interviews with industry professionals who work in film, television, theater, among other areas of the arts. It is my honor to have actor Nancy Olsen Livingston, who has appeared in several plays, films, and on television. Some of her screen credits include some of the greatest films ever made, like Sunset Boulevard, The Absent-Minded Professor, Pollyanna, and another film noir called Union Station. We're discussing her fantastic book today, which just came out last year, A Front Row Seat, An Intimate Look at Broadway, Hollywood, and the Age of Glamour. Nancy, welcome. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much, Robert. Robert, I have to tell you something.
Yes.
There is something interesting happening. The moment we became on the air, your face is gone, and now I'm reading a little. This meeting is being recorded by the host of a participant, et cetera. When are you going to come back and look at me?
Oh, you know what it is? It's because Zoom is telling you that it's being recorded.
Or it says leave meeting or got it? Which one
yeah,
should I
put? Got it. It's the one that says got it.
Oh, there you are.
There we go. There we go.
Hello.
I think it's just giving you, in case people are not comfortable being recorded, they can just say, I don't want to be recorded and hit the leave button, but yeah, so it's kind of a warning. But now that we could see each other, we could jump back in. I wanted to ask off the top, because you begin the book with the letter you wrote your daughters in the mid-80s when your first husband, Adlin Lerner, died. And then later in the book, when your second husband, Alan Livingston, died, you wrote another letter to your son, Christopher, that I'm going to share my story and our story with both of your fathers, and it's going to be on its way. And so this is the book is basically that. So what went from sharing it just with your family to wanting to then share it with the world?
I gave it to some friends who wanted to know more about my life. Plus, by the way, this took me years. I wrote that letter in 1986 when Alan Lerner died. That's a long time ago. And I put the letter away for a couple of years. And then I found it and I thought, you know, I think the children would like to have that history. And it's part of, you know, the world, part of changing in the world at that time. And so I started to write it, and I did it in longhand. And then I asked a young woman who was a wonderful person at the computer, and I dictated it. And I had the experience of hearing my voice, tell the story, but I also had the experience of seeing it actually written and printed on the screen, so that I had a sense of both, which is an odd way to write a book, I understand. But anyway, I gave it to Alan Rohde, who was a wonderful writer himself and writes about Hollywood all the time, and also interviewed me. And he was such a fabulous interviewer that I thought, I'd love to know what he thinks of this. And he said, Nancy, you have to publish this book. This is part of history. And this is part of, you know, a special part of history. And you've known people of the 20th century. You not only observed them, but you actually had a relationship with them.
Yeah.
And so that you should definitely, this is part of history and you should have it out. And he said it to the University of Kentucky Press.
Yeah, right.
And they're quite wonderful, by the way. And they thought about it a long time, and I actually forgot about it. And then suddenly I got a phone call from Alan saying, guess what? They want to publish your book. So that, it took a long time.
Right.
And it was an interesting experience, actually. The first person I gave it to had a published successful book, and she gave it to her agent. And he said, this will never be done. So
really,
I let it go. And then Alan gave it.
Did they say why? Did they give you any feedback as to why it couldn't be done?
They just, not really. The one thing they said was, she should definitely eliminate describing what she wore. And I cannot tell you the reaction I get from men as well as women about my description of what yes. I wore to these various events, because it describes an era that is completely changed
yes.
from
yes.
then to today. And that they find it, they said, I can see you walking in the room.
Yeah.
With what the color of your dress and your shoes.
I love that as well, because I felt like I was there. As you said, just the way people don't dress like that as much nowadays. So it had
no,
a real
they do not.
It brought me right into the time and place. But like I said, I love the book. And what, as I mentioned before we started to record, because of course I knew you from these masterpieces like Sunset Boulevard, but reading a memoir, you know, particularly of someone from Hollywood and an actor, I never would have expected that so quickly you didn't want the stardom that came with Hollywood, you know, from the time you were only in your early 20s. So I was curious, now did that have a lot to do with what Sunset Boulevard was about?
Yes.
You know, as you said, the, you know, people being used as commodities and bought and sold, or was it also because, as you said, as a, you know, as from the being from the Midwest, you wanted a family, you wanted children, you wanted a bigger life than just acting, or is it too complex to sort of give a simple answer to?
it's a variety of things, right. But first of all, being in my early 20s and I was still going to UCLA when I was signed to Paramount, suddenly my fellow student friends were somewhat distant. They, you know, I was being groomed to be a movie star, so that there was an awkward kind ofness between us. And also, I was there at 7 a.m. and for makeup and hair, I was on the set at 9:00 in this huge space with walls, you know, 7 feet wide, right. So that there was no noise from the outside. And I was with a makeup man, a wardrobe woman, the assistant director, and I was, where were my friends? Where was my life?
Mm.
Where were my relationships? And I worked until 6:00, went home just long enough to take off my makeup and shower and start working on the next day. And this was not a life.
Right.
This was being isolated.
Mm.
Plus, I was being sold as this new, sexy, beautiful young woman. And I, you know, people like one of the publicity people at Paramount said, Howard Hughes wants to meet you.
Right.
Well, I knew about Howard Hughes, and I wrote a chapter about meeting him and putting him off. But why in the world would I have to do that? The whole thing, a doctor's daughter from the Midwest, from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, was saying, wait a minute. Plus, the women stars that I observed did not have happy lives,
right?
Personal lives. Very few had the relationship with a man that I was looking for. And
that's interesting.
So that put me off too.
Wow, yeah. And was it just boring in general too? Like, were you just like...
Well, there was a lot of boredom, yes.
Yeah.
But there was also, I must say, Sunset was fascinating.
Right.
Because I mean, Eric von Stroheim, Bill Holden, who was, by the way, at the bottom of his career at that point.
Right.
He was being saved by Billy Wilder.
Yes.
And he knew it. And he was the perfect person to be cast because he was portraying Joe Gillis, who was a man who was desperate, and so was Bill.
Yeah.
And Bill was already drinking too much. His marriage was failing. His career was not doing anything exciting or interesting. And he was desperate himself. And that was perfect for Joe Gillis. He was a desperate man who sold his soul to Norma Desmond for his survival.
Right.
And I, my character, by the way, one of the reasons I think that Billy cast me, because how he didn't really know whether I could deliver, but he wanted somebody very specific, that Betty Schaefer. And he would stop me on the lot and talk to me about what's going to UCLA like, what was growing up in the Midwest like. And because I sounded like a straightforward, educated young woman, young girl, that's who Betty Schaefer was. However, Betty Schaefer also was an opportunist. She recognized that Joe Gillis had a gift, a talent for writing that could help her.
Yes.
And her dream, her career.
Yes.
Her upward mobility. And in the process, she fell in love with a man who sold his soul for survival.
Right.
So it's a tragedy all the way around.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's I'm sure that when you were making this film, and then not long after this, you did another film with William Holden called Union Station. Today, people talk about those movies as being classic film noirs. I'm just curious what you think of the film noir scholarship in general. Does it come as a surprise to you that people were seeing these films with similar themes and similar the structure of the script and the German expressionism and the themes? Did that come as a surprise to you? I don't know if you had any opinions about the film noir scholarship in general.
I didn't at that time really understand it. I remember that, first of all, my parents did not believe in my brother and I going to the movies and just seeing everything. They were very careful about what we saw. And because educated people, this was important to them.
Right.
And there were movies being made that were about things that they didn't want us to get into. But I remember the first film I ever saw was Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. And I was struck by the beauty of it, the incredible genius. I mean, when you saw Snow White dancing with the Seven Dwarfs, it was something unbelievable.
Oh, for sure.
And then I saw, I always forget the name of the movie, Judy Garland and meeting the straw man and the lion.
The Wizard of Oz. Yeah.
The Wizard of Oz is a piece of genius.
Oh, yeah.
And then I saw Clark Gable and incredible book about the South. And the
Gone with the Wind.
Gone with the Wind, sorry. You know how old I am, so you understand. But Gone with the Wind, that was movie making at a level of extraordinary genius.
Truly. Oh, absolutely.
And so that, therefore, I took films seriously as a gift when you went to the theater to see something. And to be part of it was, I thought, fabulous. amazing.
Mm.
And by the way, Bill and I, we did 4 pictures together, actually.
Right.
And we had a friendship that was really filled with affection. And there's, I don't remember if I wrote this, but there was a moment when I was married to Alan Livingston, my second husband, and we were on our way to London. And so we flew from LA to Kennedy and changing, we were going to change planes to go then from Kennedy Airport to London. And we were walking down a hallway to the next gate, and there was a voice at the end of the hall behind me. And it said, Nancy. And I thought, I know that voice. And I turned around and I said, and we'd not seen each other for a couple of years. And we ran toward each other down the hall and we hugged and we kissed. And he said, my God, how are you? And I said, how are you? You were married again. Are you okay? He said, you're married again. Anyway, and a man, this is a true story. A man walked by and tapped us on the shoulder and said, excuse me, but I just have to say something. This is better than watching an old movie.
I love that. Yeah, you did. You did put that in the book.
Did I? Oh, good.
I couldn't help but get goosebumps when you mentioned that the building that he died in is the same.
The Oceana.
Yeah, that you stayed at many times. It's
for many years, every summer.
Yeah. Wow.
I know. Wow. It had a completion of a sad ending.
Yeah. Yeah. I was quite shocked by that. How did you react to his death? Was that
I wept.
Yeah,
of course. I bet. I was stunned and sad.
Mm.
And filled with memories.
Right. Right. Yeah, no, he was such a fantastic actor. I was curious when you were studying acting in theater at UCLA, did you learn a specific approach to acting? Did they do, like, was they Stanislavski based, or I don't know if you, do you remember much of the training there?
I think that the importance that one gets going to a university and majoring in theater art is that you not only deal with contemporary writers, but you are also dealing with Shakespeare and Moliere and a different period of writing and expressing and thinking. And it's amazing. Now, the thing about the theater is that you're dealing with a proscenium arch. Motion pictures, you're dealing with a camera. So that you don't go to, I did write this, that Alan Lerner, who is a brilliant writer,
yeah,
said you don't go to a bookstore to buy a screenplay.
That's
true. But you do go to get Shakespeare.
Right, of course.
Or Tennessee Williams.
Yeah.
So, because it's the literature, it's the language that gives you the plot, the emotion. The camera, with one close-up and one tear going down your cheek, tells the whole story.
Yeah.
You don't have to say it.
Right.
You are showing your emotion, not
right.
expressing it. But I think that for any budding performer, to have the university experience is really a big, big plus.
Definitely. In general, or for you, do you think even actors, that would be
actors,
a good idea?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Right.
You kind of dig into what the meaning of and why to express it out loud.
Mm.
It's interesting.
Did you have a preference between film and theater? I know you were on Broadway a number of times. Did you like one more than the other?
Well, I think working with a live audience is quite an experience.
Yes.
Especially comedy. Because if you do comedy on film, there's not an audience reacting. No, no, no. Right. So you have to be funny on your own.
That's true.
And every audience is different. So that you get a different reaction every performance, which is fascinating. And you have to learn how to not, you're whispering supposedly on stage, but you have to hit the top balcony.
Yeah. Right.
So it's a different technique. And I enjoyed it. The problem is that there's a lot of pressure, and it takes away the time that your social part of your day, which is having dinner with friends and spending the evening. You're right. At the theater working. You get there, an hour before, and you put on makeup and then and you get get quiet, and then you go.
Right.
And when I was finished with working, at 11 o'clock at night, I was hyped up and everybody else wanted to go home and go to bed.
Right. Right. It's such a rush after leaving the stage in front of an audience. It keeps you up.
It sure does.
Was it difficult to adjust from theater to film when you were at UCLA doing plays and then getting on camera to then go from projecting to, being able to just be subtle and quieter? Or was that easy for you?
I had to learn it.
Yeah.
And it was very important that I did this awful film, Canadian Pacific, which is the first film I ever made.
Right.
With, what's his name, who was as old as my father. And I was playing, it was in color, by the way, Canadian Pacific. And I was playing somebody who was half Indian, Canadian Indian. And I'm a blue-eyed Scandinavian. and I said to the talent department, who said, this is what you're going to do. I said, do I look like an Indian? And they said, oh, they're going to dye your hair very, very dark. And I did have darker blonde hair then. But in the summer, I had white streaks, with the sun. And anyway, but I learned about dealing with the camera.
Right. And so it was an education.
Absolutely.
Right.
It was like going to school. So that when I did Sunset, I was prepared.
I see.
I understood how the camera worked a little bit. There's a long shot and there's a close up.
Right. Right. Fantastic. Yeah. I haven't seen Canadian Pacific yet, but at least it was a learning experience for you. There was something you said that was interesting about your first marriage with Alan Lerner was you said that some things that happened to you in childhood you want to learn about when you're an adult in the relationship. So you talked about him needing to sort of fall in love again and again, over and over again. And so did you ever kind of figure out why that was a personality type that you were drawn
I finally did understand it. And the only way that Alan could feel Alan Lerner, I'm married to two Alans, Alan Lerner could feel whole.
Right.
Was through the eyes of somebody falling in love with him.
Right.
Therefore, he had to keep seducing over and over again. He was married 8 times.
Wow. I know.
And there was a 9th in the wings, only he got cancer and died.
Right.
So but also you had to be a particular kind of woman to allow that to be, for you to be taken in. And I had some problems with my relationship with my mother and father. My father adored me and my mother was jealous of it. So I was trying to figure out how to solve that. So I was going to fall in love with a man who is not who was going to betray me.
Oh, I see. Right.
And I had went to the most amazing psychologist, Diana Kemeny, and she was incredible. And within 6 months, I could not fall in love with that kind of man ever again. And that's when I met Alan Livingston. And Alan Livingston would never betray me if somebody put a gun to his head.
Right.
And he wouldn't have interested me before. But he interested me then.
Thank God.
He was a grown-up.
Right.
That's totally.
Yeah. So something that you talked about was his Alan Livingston was his instinct for being able to see great talent that people will always remember, like signing the Beatles, for example, in America, bringing Frank Sinatra's career back in the 50s when everyone thought his career was over. Where do you think this instinct of his came from? Any idea how he was able to just spot talent so well?
Alan Livingston had his own genius. He understood the core of the gift of the writer, the performer, the musician. When the agent called him and said, you know, would you be interested in signing Frank Sinatra? That's when Columbia let Frank go and said, his career is over. It's finished. Mm-hmm. He will never sell another record. And Alan said, I would. And they said, you would? They were surprised. And Alan said, Frank is the most gifted interpreter of the American song than anyone who's recording today. And so he met with Frank, signed him to a 7-year standard contract, and said, I want to put you with Nelson Riddle. I think the two of you would go together. And Alan said, no, I only work with Alex Stordahl, and that's it, Alan. And typical Alan Livingston said, okay, Frank, let's put some singles out, see how we do. In the meantime, he contacted Nelson Riddle and said, I'm waiting for the right song. Now, publishers, by the way, went to all these people who are running these record companies trying to have their artists sing their songs, the publisher music publishing. Well, they brought Alan the song Young at Heart. And he recognized immediately that everybody was going to record it. And to get out there first was important. He called Frank. And Alex Stordahl was already recording something else in New York City. And he called Frank and he said, listen, Frank, this song, I'm going to send it to you. It's your song. You can interpret this lyric better than anyone. Alex Stordahl is in New York. I have the studio on Sunday afternoon. We have to hurry and get this out. And I've got Nelson Riddle, who was willing and able now to do the put together, you know, the orchestration.
Right.
Just this once, he said, would you please be willing to do that with Nelson? And Frank said he read the lyric. He always read the lyric first, by the way, Frank Sinatra. Well, right. Bing Crosby always listened to the music first.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
And what Frank wanted to know was, what is this song about? And the lyric was the thing that interested him. Then he'd listen to the music. Anyway, that Sunday afternoon, they recorded Young at Heart. Well, it was off the chart. I mean, it sold a million copies within a week, you know. And so there was a new relationship that Frank had with Nelson Riddle. And completely re-emerged his talent and his career.
Fantastic. Were you a fan of, it's interesting because you talk about Sinatra in the book having some conflicts later with your husband, yes. Alan, and then he was sort of turned his back on the two of you when he ran into you somewhere. Were you ever a fan of any of these musicians or actors who you met in life and just thought, oh God, I don't think I like your music anymore just because of this?
No. I love Frank Sinatra from the first time I heard him sing. Right. And when I heard the orchestrations of Nelson Riddle and the combination of the two, I mean, what could be more wonderful to listen to?
Oh, it's so and good.
So, but what happened was that Alan left Capitol and went to NBC television. And NBC, by the way, wanted to get rid of Alan at Capitol because Capitol was taking over the whole record industry because of Alan. So, and Alan thought, maybe the record business is something I don't want to stay with forever. So he went to NBC television and ran the vice president of representing LA. And he created Bonanza.
Mm. Yes. Wow. And it's amazing all he did. It's incredible.
And gave it its title, had his brother Jay do da-da-da-da-da-da, you know.
Yes.
But the head of television in New York was somebody who had a problem with alcohol and ego. And he was buttering up Bobby Sarnoff, who was the president of the whole RCA, you know, empire. His father, General Sarnoff, was the one who started the whole thing. And Alan heard, he was trying to sell Bonanza through an advertiser on Madison Avenue, and they kept turning him down. And then finally, somebody who was a friend of Alan's called him and said, Alan, you have to understand something. The president of NBC television, this very odd, difficult man, has told everyone that anything Alan Livingston brings is dead on arrival.
Wow.
People's egos are something, yeah. Aren't they?
Unbelievable.
But guess what happened? Alan went to General Sarnoff, who always admired Alan,
mm-hmm.
and said, I have to leave, and told him the story. And he said, look, Alan, he said, Bobby is my son. He likes this man. I cannot interfere with that. So he said, but I'll do you a favor. He said, I promise. We will put out the first 9 episodes and we will own them. We will not get a advertising person to be the producers. We will put out, it'll be owned by NBC. Well, it became the number one, possibly one of the most valuable properties that they've ever had. They did something like 14 years.
Wow.
Can you imagine?
Unbelievable.
But Alan, I truly am very disturbed at that memory. And also many people at Capitol Records, because then Alan went back to Capitol and signed the Beach Boys, the Beatles, the band, started a classical label. But there were people with knives out who resented Alan. And Alan was this focused person on talent and what made it happen and how to bring it into the public.
Right.
This was his gift. And he wasn't looking to say, why are you holding that knife?
Right.
People's egos. It reminds me very much of politics today.
Yes. I know. It's so petty. Just want to destroy people because they might get ahead of you.
Yes. Yes.
Wow.
It's truly, and I don't see the world growing up.
It's very childish.
Yes.
Wow. I was actually on the topic of politics. One thing that was interesting in the book was that Alan Livingston, you mentioned was a Republican, and you're a Democrat, and you also got along well with other, you know, John Wayne, who was Republican, and Fred McMurray, and even had a relationship with the Reagans. It's interesting because my impression today is that the people on the left or the right cannot find any common ground or get along at all. So I was curious, how did you get over or beyond just political views and still have good relationships with people?
Alan Livingston was a wonderful human being. And yet I think being responsible for a large company, the emphasis was on helping that company grow and not having the Democrats come in and take away that process.
Right, right.
Or slow it down. But listen, his last vote before he died was for Obama.
Oh.
So good. That made me very happy, I must say. Yes. I never quite forgave him for voting for Reagan, because it was too obvious to me that Reagan was not the person to be president.
Mm. How were you able to still get along with them? Were you able to just put politics aside, or is that hard?
Everybody knew. I was very outspoken. Right. Everybody knew that I was a very moderate. No, maybe a little to the left of being a Democrat. I'm basically in the middle, but more shifted. I more definitely am over more to the left than to the right. That's for sure.
Right. Right.
They accepted me, but they, for different reasons. I mean, I was then the president of Blue Ribbon, and I was being written about every other week in the LA Times, and so was Alan. And so therefore we had a image in the community that was desirable. I mean, it's really, that's what it boils down to.
I see. Oh, I see. Did you like Ronald and Nancy personally? Did you find them fun to be around, or
I met them when Ronnie was really diminishing. He was beginning dementia, and I would be at a dinner party, small dinner party with him, and he would tell a joke at the dining room table. And then he'd get up, and then later he'd get his group together and say, "I got to tell you a great joke." And he'd repeat himself.
Mm-hmm.
So as I, you know, I had that experience of writing a script for him at one of the Blue Ribbon events, and he showed up, and he shocked Nancy. He shocked the audience. It was a huge success. I couldn't believe it. I wrote the script, had one of the Reaganites take it to him and his secretary. And he said, "I will do this. Nancy Reagan, his wife, does not find out. And that no one knows this except Nancy Livingston, Joanne, the president, the people backstage at the taper. That's it."
Right.
And when the stage manager came back at the back of the theater and gave me the signal that Ronnie was in place, they were questioning Nancy about, you know, life. And I said, "Excuse me, I just have to ask a question. I just a burning question. Nancy, Mrs. Reagan, every photograph that you have ever been in with the president, you look at him with such adoration, such love, such concentration. I said, do you actually feel that way every time? And then a voice from backstage says, Nancy, before you answer that question, right, I'd like a word with you. And he came out.
I love that story.
Oh my God. The audience was, that was the end of it. We all went to lunch with Nancy Reagan. But Nancy was, oh, but we had breakfast. And you never mentioned this. And then he took her down to center stage, put his arm around her. I'll never forget. And he said, when this lady leaves the room, I miss her. And the audience went, ah. And that was the end. So Alan, that evening, he knew all about this and, you know, was helping me with the script and we, you know, the whole thing. He was fascinated. And we had our little drink together, which we had every night before dinner, right, with some fun, you know, his records in the background. He liked the violin concertos. I liked the piano concertos because those were instruments we played. And he said, okay, tell me about it. What happened? And I said, Alan, before I tell you, I have a question. If I left the room, would you miss me? And he left me and he said, Nancy, you're coming back, aren't you?
I love that. That's another great story in the book. So many wonderful stories. Well, one thing that I really liked the book was how much you talk about others. It's not just about you. It's like all these people that we're discussing and your children and all these stories, which is so, again, which is not as common with memoirs that I've read anyways. Yeah. I mean, maybe they are, but at least maybe not Hollywood ones. You know, it seems to be more about that. I mean, obviously this is your experiences in your life, but it's so large. There's so many characters and your interests in others, which I found quite fascinating. Well,
that's what has been interesting about my life.
Yeah, right.
Is that I have known and had relationships and experiences with some of the most interesting people in the world.
Right, which goes into the title of Front Row Seats. Yeah. Perfect. Yeah.
Well, I had a conversation with my friend Scott Berg, who is the writer, the biographer. And he said, well, Nancy, he said, well, I told him I was writing this. And I said, I wonder maybe someday it'll get published. Who knows? And he said, but, you know, you should be writing it because you always had a front row seat. And I said, right, Scott, you've just given me the title.
That's perfect. Such a great title. I love it. A front row seat. I was curious if you had any favorite films. Is there any movies you like to see again and again?
No, but I'll tell you something. Snowball Express, which is not a great movie, is the last picture I did at Disney.
Right.
It's not a great script. So it doesn't really work. You've got to have a script.
Right.
And, but I have never looked as well in any movie before or whenever today as I looked in every single shot of that movie. And that kind of fascinated me. And I don't see it, but the other night, a couple of years ago, it was on it, you know, on one of the late things. And somebody turned it on and I sat and watched it and thought how sad that it was such a poorly written script. And I looked amazing. That's the only film that I really felt that way about. It's interesting, but how you look has always been a part of the mystery of my life, because my mother kept saying over the years, you're not nearly as pretty as everyone tells you you are. And so I was wondering, I never thought I was.
Right.
So it's always been a little bit of an obsession, because I will say when I dress up and go out, do I look okay?
Mm.
But it isn't because I want a compliment. It's because I really want to know.
Right. Right.
So strange.
When was that film roughly? That one I haven't seen.
It was after The Absent-Minded Professor, and the next, you know, we did a sequel to the, which was awful. The Absent-Minded Professor is truly, absolutely a fabulous film.
Oh yeah, I love that.
Not
one.
Because of me, but because it's just a great film.
You had great, you, the chemistry between you and Fred McMurray, I thought was was great. You were both playing off each other so beautifully. I really liked that one. And I also just saw for the first time, and my wife said she loved it ever since she was a kid, was Pollyanna. That is such a great, great film.
It is truly. And, you know, I thought I was never going to make another film ever and didn't care. And right. I was in Mallorca, and I get a call from the Walt Disney, for God's sake, what? And he said, look, we're going to now go from not just our animation, excuse me, but he said, we are now going to do a film that we're going to spend more money on. And he said, every character is well known. I mean, is a really established actor. Agnes Moorehead and Karl Marx and Karl Malden.
That's right. Yeah, Karl Malden. Yeah.
And Jane Wyman. And it went on and on. And he said, we want you. And I said, well, when are you going to do it? He said, at the end of August. I was coming to California with my two children to be with my, at the Oceana. With my two children to be with their grandparents. My parents now lived in Brentwood Park, very near the Oceana. And I said, well, I'm coming there anyway. And it's not a huge demanding role. He said, you know. And so I said, oh, sure, I'll do it. And that's how it began to progress at Disney. Once I did that, then they went into the Absent-Minded Professor.
I see. Yeah, because that was just before, I believe. Pollyanna was just before Absent-Minded Professor.
Right. It was made first. And then the next summer, living at the Oceana again in August. Perfect. Before the children had to come back to New York and go to school. So anyway.
Yeah, no, it's such a wonderful film. I wanted to show it to my son, and he didn't want to watch it, and then he found himself getting drawn into it.
Yes.
He was on the computer, and then suddenly he wanted to watch it. So I think it's wonderful for children and adults. Wonderful family film. I just had one last question. I was curious, when you were writing the book and looking back on your life, was there anything that you learned about yourself that just hadn't dawned on you before? Anything that was in your part of your subconscious that suddenly became conscious? Or I'm sure maybe it was a lot of things, but anything come to mind?
You know, it was important for me in writing the book to be as honest about my experiences and how I felt as I could possibly be, because I was writing to my children and my grandchildren. And so I wanted them to really experience what I felt was important that I experienced. And so that was a very motivating factor. It was hard for me to end the book. I didn't know how.
Mm.
And then I came up with the idea that we all arrive with an empty canvas.
Yeah, I love that.
And accompanied with, you know, a palette of colors, which represents our background, our IQ, our temperament, our shape of our nose.
Mm-hmm.
And we start painting, but other people start painting on our canvas as we interact with their palettes and their colors.
Yes.
And I said that almost at the end, that my canvas is almost finished. But you recognize that that's me.
Mm-hmm.
And what's fascinating when I began to think about this is that everybody, and there's so many people in the world, their canvas is totally different and unique. And that's how I finally had to end it.
I love that. Such a great metaphor for life, the way you put it. I thought it was a perfect ending. So what a fantastic read. Again, I really, really enjoyed it. And for anyone who is a classic Hollywood fan or just a theater fan, or and even if you like books, politics, there's so much music. There's so much packed into this. So I highly recommend checking out Nancy Olson Livingston, A Front Row Seat. Nancy, thanks so much for coming on and sharing your story with the world and sharing the last hour with me. So I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much. I enjoyed it.
Thank you so much, everyone, for watching. If this is your first time here on my YouTube channel, please consider subscribing by pressing the Robert Bellissimo at the Movies logo. You will see it floating above my head in the top left corner, to your top left, in just a second. Just click on that and then click the bell in order to get a notification every time I release one of my new episodes or when I go live. Thank you so much, everyone. I will see you in the next episode.